This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. Red, Black, and Green, a Blues is a moving, hybrid work that brings the stories and voices of Black America into the center of a timely conversation about race, class, culture, and the environment. We're going to talk about it today with award-winning performance artist, educator, and essayist Mark Bamuti-Joseph and founding director of the Trauma Services of Children's Hospital and founder of Core Change. We hope Dr. Victor Garcia will be joining us in just a short while. We'd like to hear from you, too. You can call in at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good afternoon, Mark.
Hey, good afternoon.
So you wrote this. Tell us what it's about.
I did. It is a performed documentary about the process of producing eco-festivals in four under-resourced parks across America. The festivals, which are called Life is Living, happened in Harlem, in Chicago, in Houston, and in Oakland. And over the course of an hour and a half, we take an audience, and I use the word audience incorrectly, we construct a community inside of theatrical space in order to see and also reimagine what the possibilities are around sustainable survival practices across this country.
So there's a whole lot going on.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot going on in there.
Yeah.
Tell us, where did the idea come from? Where did you decide that, hey, this might be a great performance?
I was working with Robert Redford and the Sundance Institute and also working with a nonprofit organization called Youth Speaks. And our collaboration was to provide platforms for young writers between 13 and 19 to perform pieces about the environment all over the world. And so the young poets were presenting work, let's say, with Desmond Tutu or Bill Clinton. But wherever these pieces about environment were being spoken, there were very few folks of color in attendance or in the audience. So what was clear was that the national platform or kind of the mainstream conversation around green and green politics was approaching a kind of segregation that ultimately will be detrimental not just to the isolated or vulnerable communities, but to us all. You know, environment is one of those things where either we all get in or we all burn, you know. So the idea for the festivals was to engage Black and brown communities in the environmental conversation, but to do it in such a way that honored the social and physical architecture of the communities that we were engaging. And then so Red, Black, and Green came out of that as a way to document what we were doing and to create a pathway, I think, to empathy around environment in the performative context.
So these events actually did happen.
Yeah, they happen and continue to happen. We will have a Life is Living exercise in Oakland in October. There'll be one in Philadelphia in July. These have happened in Minneapolis and San Francisco, in Washington, D.C., primarily through the auspices of an organizing model that we call the creative ecosystem. We believe that what sustains neighborhoods ultimately are the people, and that people are responsible for environmental responsibility, activity, and consciousness. So we work with cohorts around the country in order to produce these festivals, but more importantly, to produce these cohorts, learning communities that advocate for sustainability and interdependence.
So in the show, when you bring all this together, it sounds like it could be a very serious subject, but the show's not only serious.
Yeah, we're pretty funny. You know, my castmates are really good looking and talented. There's incredible music. There's, you know, it's a show. And at the same time, there's a kind of investment, of implication of all that are involved that is emotionally serious as well as dramaturgically light. And I will say that there's that our set, which was created by the artist Theaster Gates, is central to how the show operates. It functions as four separate modular pieces that come together to form a shotgun house. And there's metaphorical...
A shotgun house is one of those that just goes room after room after room, straight
through.
Yeah,
just straight through. A row house, which is the kind of house that I lived in when we were making the festival and cohort happen in Houston. And so it really is pretty visually and viscerally captivating in very many ways. The choreography by Stacey Prince, the direction by Michael John Garces, the video design by David Slaza and Eli Jacobs Fantauzi, all these folks came together to impress upon us not just aesthetic beauty, but emotional resonance.
Who are you hoping comes out to see the show?
Every single body.
But are you directed to anyone in particular, or?
You know, I'm a 38-year-old African-American man. I'm the son of immigrants. I'm a first-generation American. I'm a father. I'm a New Yorker. I'm a California transplant. I'm a soccer player. ESPN is on all the time, right? I am all of these things. I write from the multiplicity of those perspectives. But one of the kind of ascendant characteristics that I aspire to is pedagogue and educator. And in the classroom, I find that you know, our purpose isn't to compartmentalize information for segmented communities. The purpose in the classroom, and I think the purpose of theater, is to create multiple avenues for access. And so I want young and old, brown, black, white, and in between. I want Scorpios and Geminis. I want politicians, athletes, you know, again, environmental stewardship is something that we all have to pay attention to. And you need look no further than the recent climate reports that came out of the White House, the images of, you know, polar bears floating on ice. Like, these are the kind of, you know, ubiquitous images and scientific entities that would tell us one story. But I think what's great about the theater piece is that we don't necessarily address the science. We address the social architecture of environmental possibility and accountability. And that's something that I think we can all buy into.
As you're performing, what are you hoping people take from it? What are you hoping when they, after they see the performance, they may do differently once they get home, or not?
You know, there's a whole segment of the piece where we just kind of rattle off all the things that you could do, from, you know, composting and recycling to, you know, committing to sustainable land use and affordable, equitable transit and making your own baby food, taking your mug to the coffee shop, et cetera. There are a list of 1,000 activities that we can all do. But our attitude, I think, about environment is... maybe what's the psychology around these practices, I think, is what gets engaged in a different way. So, I'm not going to prescribe to anybody, you know, the 15 things that they have to do before the Earth spins off its axis. The Earth actually won't spin off its axis. It'll just spin us off, like, you know, the spin cycle or something. So this is not about prescribed activity. This really is about emotional engagement in a way that impacts us all. In the same way that I could probably list a prescribed list of ways that we could be less sexist or less racist, but these things ultimately cut to the heart. Right. And I think that's what art has the power to do, is kind of cut through scientific jargon and get to the heart. And that's what I hope to inflame inside of the theatrical space.
Now, you've done more than just have these performances coming up. I think it's tonight and tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But you've done other community events through the week here in town. What kind of things have you done, and what's the reaction been?
The reaction has been amazing. I landed here Wednesday morning, and by Wednesday evening, we were having a community conversation as part of the CAC's Conversation Cafe series, in which me and the good doctor talked a little bit about how it is that we've been organizing in the face of kind of systemic pathologies in under-resourced communities, how we've organized and cut through. And led by Peter Brock, we had facilitated both presentation and conversation with a group of about 50 folks that came to the CAC specifically to think together.
Broad audience.
Broad audience, yeah. And you know, and we repeated kind of a similar exercise last night at the Findlay Market. And, you know, what's happening in this city in terms of a burgeoning economy, in terms of a gentry class, in terms of, you know, the verticality that capitalism, you know, lovingly creates inside of all our social spaces. You know, this is an international phenomenon and certainly a national phenomenon. Wherever I go, whether it's Oakland, California, or Asheville, North Carolina, or Cincinnati, Ohio, we're dealing with these issues of economic disparity and how that plays into our definitions of community and belonging. And so both at Findlay Market and at the CAC, that was the core of our conversation. And in both conversations, you know, what I loved was all, I think, were encouraged to meet again, that these moments in time are only episodic and fleeting, and that ultimately what builds community is relationship. And so the advocacy, I think, in both cases was for these disparate thinkers, most of whom did not know each other, but were clearly engaged in the desire to make our immediate social borders more welcoming to all. You know, we invited them to meet in other places, to meet in under-resourced neighborhoods, to create a culture of invitation, and to continue getting together towards, if not policy change, then certainly attitude change within the communities that they wish to engage.
What'd they talk about?
Oh, wow. You know, the at Findlay Market in particular, I think what I was struck by was the guilt, trouble, issues with kind of an encroaching, the encroaching arrival of the gentry in historically African-American neighborhoods and what that meant. The Findlay Market, which, you know, I was told has a fairly burgeoning population, African-American population of patronage during the week that all disappears during the weekend as folks from the city, from the exurbs and, you know, and surrounding areas come in, and it becomes more of a tourist space. Right. So so that's kind of the primary tension, I would say, that was alive in the conversation yesterday is how do we recede the kind of thrush of economic disparity inside of, you know, inside of these spaces. At the CAC, I think that the conversation was a little bit more aspirational, that there was less focus on problem and more focus on possibility and potential and desire to be inclusive in a conversation around a lot of the same political and economic phenomenon, but maybe because the audience at CAC skewed a little bit more towards arts loving, there was kind of an undercurrent of the embrace of beauty in what right now is a troubling situation.
We're talking to award-winning performance artist, educator, and essayist Mark Bamuthi. Say it for me.
Bamuthi.
Bamuthi Joseph, and founding director of Trauma Services of Children's Hospital and founder of Core Change, Dr. Victor Garcia, who we hope will be joining us shortly. And if you have a question or a comment, we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 513-419-7100. You can email us, talk at WVXU.org. Also find us on Facebook and Twitter. And again, Mark's show will be Red, Black, and Green, a Blues will be performed tonight and tomorrow, right?
Yes.
And you can find out all about that on our website, WVXU.org. We have a link to that as well. So you've talked a lot about the environment, and you've talked about race, and you've talked a little bit about how they go together. What is the major connection there in terms of you're having these discussions with people about race? Was the environment part of that as well, too? How did that all fit in?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, in the face of environmental calamity, the most vulnerable communities get swept up first. You know, you see that in Haiti. You see that in the aftermath of Katrina. You see it in Oklahoma, right? That and so the conversation really dealt with kind of that complex sociology and economic reality. But I think it was simpler than that. As sophisticated and as complex as these issues are, you know, I think that there's a human need to connect and to find belonging. And, you know, I'm very active on social media. I think as an artistic enterprise or as a journalistic enterprise, we have to be. And so I think more and more our points of social connection are just that. They're virtual. They're, you know, they're digital. And so the places of connection, like these kind of moments of intersection, you know, those aren't the kinds of forms that we create for ourselves. So a lot of the conversation was about these common grounds, physical common grounds within the city that we can create.
Like what?
Mostly, you know, I advocate for an organizing model called the creative ecosystem. And again, this goes back to just my lineage as a pedagogue, but I think that when folks gather around topics, we tend to share a lot of information. When folks gather around questions, we meet at the point of curiosity. And I think meeting at the level of inquiry is actually a lot more fertile and a lot more welcoming in terms of conversation. So this is something that happens through the Conversation Cafe at the Contemporary Arts Center here, but I believe it's something that we're going to begin hosting at Findlay Market and neighboring sites, and I think that's a result of the conversation that we had last night.
But you're only in town for a short while. You're hoping this just continues on once you leave?
Well, you know, it's not up to me. Do you know what I mean? I think with any kind of organizing principle or organizing module, we organize around the principle, not around any person or any leader. You know, yes, we can, et cetera, et cetera. Right. So when we focus on one person as, you know, as the driver or one person's ideas, you know, as the driver of any kind of organizing module, then that organizing module tends to wither. You know, ultimately, it's a critical mass of people that make it happen or not. And I think that what happened this week was incendiary and catalytic. But the folks that gathered, it's up to them to take ownership, just like we have to take ownership of our country.
Now, you've done this in other cities, right?
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about what you find is going on once that conversation started and you left town. What happened? Do you have any success stories you want to share?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the most successful story is in Houston in Third Ward, primarily because we have an amazing institutional partner in Project Row Houses under the direction of a man named Rick Lowe. But you know, Project Row Houses was constructed more than 30 years ago, or was organized more than 30 years ago, specifically to have impact in discarded community. And so the value system that comes out of Project Row Houses feeds really beautifully into what we're trying to accomplish here. So, you know, the group that started to gather around Life is Living, which we produced in 2010, still continues to meet. Now, these are folks from various, you know, vocational vectors, right? So so some are artists, some are athletes, some are community-based organization leaders, some are politicians, et cetera. But they come together around this question of what sustains life, and everyone brings their thing. So someone from the Bush Cares Project, which advocates for and does specific work with homeless military veterans, is sitting next to someone from Aerosol Warfare, which is a crew of graffiti artists that provide free graffiti workshops, right? And that kind of hybridity in terms of the organizing sets folks off on a different course in terms of how they program, how they fundraise. You know, folks from Aerosol Warfare can do signs for a state senator to message that state senator's, you know, policy vision a little bit differently. So these are how they work, right? This kind of neighborhood accountability or this kind of interdependent community making, I think, ultimately is the foundation for how we take on the stewardship, not just of our local areas, but then the planet itself.
Your performance, Red, Black, and Green, a Blues, is a lot of storytelling, of all sorts of emotions, as we talked about, and you have a reputation for being quite a storyteller. I'm going to put you on the spot. Can you tell us a short story, or is that impossible to do?
No, it's not impossible. So, me and some community activists throw this eco party in the hood. Mos Def busting in the park on a solo powered stage, aquaponic gardens, green the ghetto, sustainable hip hop. So we produce these all over Houston, Harlem, Oakland, Chicago. I meet her in Chicago. She offers me watermelon. And I hear this guy singing, hear him moaning out molecules to river his mother's spirit down like rapids raging like injustice. And I know that she's not from this country because New World Blacks always offer each other the secret absolution handshake before we offer each other watermelon. Sudan, she says. And I'm awash in the iTunes ubiquity of the word Darfur, which I know Madonna and George Clooney really care about. I know Lost Boys. I know genocide. I don't know why they're lost. I don't know who's killing who. I'm a Starbucks activist. I know what I read between the door and my dirty soy chai. But I do know that I found a clue in the shaking voice of a mother tongue, just now loosened in the still dark shadow of the loss of her son. Inner city school kid life violently left invalid, gun blast book bag, blood-soaked Chicago morning. Me and my do-gooder friends are greening the ghetto. I ask a mother about environment. She responds in the language of disaster, the culture of hazard, summer climax of climate, 36 school kids gun blasted to the hereafter. Her son was a witness that got dealt with before he could even think to snitch. She spits out a seed, looks at me, asks the question. I ask a mother about environment. She tells me of guns, of emotionally disabled boys whose green movement consists of recycling the sorry narrative of black-on-black crime. If you brown, you can't go green until you hold respect for black life. She spits out a seed like a wasted leaf of a tree never grown, looks at me, asks the question. She shows me his picture. And if you look real close, you can see he has 21, maybe 27 and a half hairs on his chin. At first you miss the hair because the first thing you notice is his skin. If it were soil, his is the earth brown you'd want to sow in. A Chicago sun, hard times. He does not blink. So think of this brother brown, and now see this mother black. You see how dark the day becomes when you bury the sun. How you set the future back. A mother inters a murdered teen, all in the service of green.
Wow. You hit every emotion, I think, in that, too. That's really great. That's really good. And how long did it take you to prepare something like that?
You know, any writer will tell you that, you know, the writing process is ongoing. So it was not constructed in a night. There was lots of procrastination. My friend Dream Hampton shared an infographic recently where she documented the writer's process as being about 90% procrastination and, you know, 10% tearing your hair out while you cry and suffer through the work, and then it's done. So, but these stories, you know, they come out of a 3-year process, ultimately, of making these festivals happen all over the country. And, you know, but the rehearsal process, which includes choreography and film and design, you know, that was a finite process that that in its concentrated form was about 8 weeks over the course of 6 months. We premiered the piece in October 2011, and this is our last stop around the country before we come back to close out the tour in the Bay in 2015. So the last place we performed the work was at the Kennedy Center. We've been at the Walker Center, the Contemporary Art Center in Chicago, or the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago. We've been at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, some really high-powered venues all over the country, and it's an honor to bring it here.
Does the work change as you perform it, or does it stay the same? Does it evolve at all?
I think the work always evolves because we do, you know. I'm not the same being that I was 3 years ago. None of my castmates are, you know. My, you know, one of my castmates, Yao, recently got engaged. He's gonna, you know, be married in July. You know, I got married during, you know, during this period of time, right? So we all change. But seriously, you know, as soon as the audience comes into the theater, they don't take their seats. They come up on stage with us. And for the first 25 minutes of, quote, performance, the audience is embedded and inscribed in the narrative. And we find that that creates a different kind of implication and a different kind of energy, which means that the piece itself feels different every night. And that, more than anything, I think, impacts variation from one show to the next.
Getting back to the writing, one of the things that, in sitting here listening to you perform that piece, is that I really believed I could see all of that, the watermelon seeds and the hairs on the chin, and and it's very descriptive. Do you see it in your head as you're telling the story?
Unfortunately, I've seen it. And so the, or I should say fortunately, I have seen it. And I think that a lot of writers or a lot of artists will tell you that the vision comes first. Probably the question comes first, the vision comes next, and then you struggle to make what the ghosts have told you to make, you know. And that's my process. Ultimately, I want to be descriptive. I want to bring people in. But as I said earlier, more than anything, I want to create pathways. And so the spoken text is very much a part of how we communicate, but our body language, the gestural vocabulary, the choreography, and the music are also strong parts of what we do. Each city that we explore in this piece has its own musical signature. So we hear a lot of gospel in the first section. We hear blues in the second section, hip hop in the third, and soul and funk in the fourth. And all these are parts of the ways that we bring people in.
Thank you so much for being here. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
And you can see the performance tonight or tomorrow. You can find all the details about where, when, and getting tickets on our website, wvxu.org. We've been talking about Red, Black, and Green, a Blues, a presentation at the Contemporary Arts Center. My guest, award-winning performance artist, educator, and essayist, Mark Bamuthi Joseph. Bamuthi, I'm getting it wrong. I'm sorry. Mark Bamuthi Joseph. Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. Today's technical director was Bruce Ellis. Archives of our program are available on our website, wvxu.org. I'm Marianne Zalesnik.